Ryan waved her to the chair opposite his.
10 minutes before the hour. We're here in the Roosevelt Room of the White House to speak with President John Patrick Ryan, her voice cooed to the camera. Mr. President, it's been a long and difficult night for our country. What can you tell us?
Ryan had it down sufficiently pat that the answer came out devoid of conscious thought. His voice was calm and slightly mechanical, and his eyes locked on hers, as he'd been told to do. In this case, it wasn't hard to concentrate on her liquid brown eyes, though looking so deeply into them this early in the morning was disconcerting. He hoped it didn't show too much.
Mr. President, the last few months have been very traumatic for all of us, and last night was only more so. You will be meeting with your national security staff in a few minutes. What are your greatest concerns?
Joy, a long time ago, an American president said that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Our country is as strong today as yesterday.
Yes, that is true.
Daryai had met Ryan once before. He'd been arrogant and defiant then, in the way of a dog standing before his master, snarling and brave, or seemingly so. But now the master was gone, and here was the dog, eyes fixed on a beautiful but sluttish woman, and it surprised Daryai that his tongue wasn't out and drooling. Fatigue had something to do with it. Ryan was tired, that was plain to see. What else was he? He was like his country, the Ayatollah decided. Outwardly strong, perhaps. Ryan was a young man still, broad of shoulder, erect of posture. His eyes were clear and his voice firm. But when asked of his country's strength, he spoke of fear and the fear of fear. Interesting. Daryai knew well enough that strength and power were things of the mind more than the body, a fact as true of nations as of men. America was a mystery to him, as were America's leaders. But how much did he have to know? America was a godless country. That was why this Ryan boy talked of fear. Without God, both the country and the man lacked direction. Some had said that the same was true of Daryai's country, but if that were true at all, it was for a different reason, he told himself. Like people all over the world, Daryai concentrated on Ryan's face and voice. The answer to the first question was obviously mechanical. Whatever America knew about this glorious incident, they weren't telling. Probably they didn't know very much, but that was to be understood. His had been a long day, and Daryai had used it profitably. He'd called his foreign ministry and had the chief of the America desk, actually a whole department in the official building in Tehran, order a paper on the working of the American government. The situation was even better than Daryai had hoped. They could make no new laws, could levy no new taxes, could spend no new money until such time as their Congress was reconstituted, and that would require time. Almost all of their ministries were headless. This Ryan boy, Daryai was 72, was the American government, and he was not impressed with what he saw. The United States of America had thwarted him for years. So much power. Even after reducing its might following the downfall of the Soviet Union, the lesser Satan, America could do things possible for no other nation. All it needed was political resolve, and though that was rare enough, the threat of it was ever daunting. Every so often the country would rally behind a single purpose, as had happened not so long before against Iraq, with consequences so startlingly decisive as compared with what little his own country had managed in a shooting war that had lasted nearly a full decade. That was the danger of America. But America was a thinner reed now, or rather America was, if not quite headless, then nearly so. The strongest body was rendered crippled and useless by an injury to its neck, the more so from one to its head.
Just one man, Daryai thought. Not hearing the words from the television now. The words didn't matter now. Ryan wasn't saying anything of substance, but telling the man half a world away much with his demeanor. The new head of that country had a neck that became the focus of Daryai's gaze. Its symbolism was clear. The technical issue, after all, was to complete the separation of head from body, and all that stood between the two was the neck. 10 minutes to the next one, Arnie said, after Joy left to catch her car to the airport. The Fox reporter was in makeup. How am I doing? Jack disconnected the mic wire before standing this time. He needed to stretch his legs. Not bad, Van Damme judged, charitably. He might have said something else to a career politician, but a real politico would have had to field really tough questions. It was as though a golfer were playing against his handicap instead of a tour pro partner, and that was fair as far as it went. Most important, Ryan needed to have his confidence built up if he were to function at all. The presidency was hard enough at the best of times, and while every holder of that office had wished more than once to be rid of Congress and other agencies and departments as well, it was Ryan who would have to learn how indispensable the whole system of government was. And he'd learn the hard way. I have to get used to a lot, don't I? Jack leaned against the wall outside the Roosevelt room, looking up and down the corridor. You'll learn, the chief of staff promised him. Maybe so. Jack smiled, not realizing that the activity of the morning, the recent activity, had given his mind something to shunt aside the other circumstances of the day. Then a Secret Service agent handed him a slip of paper. However unfair it was to the other families, it was to be understood that the first priority had to be the body of President Derling. No fewer than 4 mobile cranes had been set up on the west side of the building, operating under the direction of hard-hatted construction foremen standing with a team of skilled workers on the floor of the chamber, much too close for safety, but OSHA wasn't around this morning. The only government inspectors who mattered were Secret Service. The FBI might have had overall jurisdiction, but no one would have stood between them and their own mournful quest. There was a doctor and a team of paramedics standing by as well, on the unlikely chance that someone might have survived despite everything to the contrary. The real trick was coordinating the actions of the cranes, which dipped into the crater. That's how it looked. Like a quartet of giraffes drinking from the same waterhole, never quite banging together due to the skill of the operators. Look here. The construction supervisor pointed. In the blackened claw of a dead hand was an automatic pistol. It had to be Andy Walker, principal agent of Roger Derling's detail. The last frame of TV had shown him within feet of his president, racing to spirit him off the podium, but too late to accomplish anything more than his own death in the line of duty. The next dip of the next crane. A cable was affixed around a block of sandstone, which rose slowly, twirling somewhat with the torsion of the steel cable. The remainder of Walker's body was now visible, along with the trousered legs of someone else. All around both were the splintered and discolored remains of the oak podium, even a few sheets of charred paper. The fire hadn't really reached through the pile of stones in this part of the ruined building. It had burned too rapidly for that. Hold it! The construction man grabbed the arm of the Secret Service agent and wouldn't let him move. They're not going anywhere. It's not worth getting killed for. Couple of more minutes. He waited for one crane to clear the path for the next, and waved his arms, telling the operator how to come in, where to dip, and when to stop. 2 workers slipped a pair of cables around the next stone block, and the foreman twirled his hand in the air. The stone lifted. "We have jumper," the agent said into his microphone. The medical team moved in at once, over the warning shouts of several construction men, but it was plain from 20 feet away that their time was wasted. His left hand held the binder containing his last speech. The falling stones had probably killed him before the fire had reached in far enough to singe his hair. Much of the body was misshapen from crushing, but the suit and the presidential tie clasp and the gold watch on his wrist positively identified President Roger Durling. Everything stopped. The cranes stood still, their diesel engines idling while their operators sipped their coffee or lit up smokes. A team of forensic photographers came in to snap their rolls of film from every possible angle. They took their time. Elsewhere on the floor of the chamber, National Guardsmen were bagging bodies and carrying them off. They'd taken over this task from the firefighters 2 hours before. But for a 50-foot circle, there were only Secret Service performing their last official duty to Jumper, as they had called the President in honor of his service as a lieutenant in the 82nd Airborne. It had gone on too long for tears, though for all of the assembled agents those would come again, more than once. When the medics withdrew, when the photographers were satisfied, four agents in Secret Service windbreakers made their way down over the remaining stone blocks. First, they lifted the body of Andy Walker, whose last conscious act had been to protect his principal, and lowered it gently into the rubberized bag. The agents held it up so that another pair of their fellows could lift it clear and take it on its way. The next task was President Durling. This proved difficult. The body was askew in death, and the cold had frozen it. One arm was at a right angle to the rest of the body and would not fit into the bag. The agents looked at one another, not knowing what to do about it. The body was evidence and could not be tampered with. Perhaps more important was their horror at hurting a body already dead. And so President Durling went into the bag with the arm outstretched like Captain Ahab's. The four agents carried it out, making their way out of the chamber, around all of the fallen blocks, and then down toward an ambulance waiting for this single purpose. That tipped off the press photographers near and far, who snapped away, or zoomed in their TV cameras to capture the moment. The moment cut into Ryan's Fox interview, and he watched the scene on the monitor that sat on the table. Somehow, in his mind, that made it official. Durling really was dead. And now he really was the President. And that was that. The camera in the room caught Ryan's face as it changed, as he remembered how Durling had brought him in, trusted him, leaned on him, guided him. That was it, Jack realized. He'd always had someone to lean on before. Sure, others had leaned on him, asked his opinion, given him his head in a crisis, but there was always someone to come back to tell him he'd done the right thing. He could do that now, but what he'd receive in return would be just opinions, not judgments. The judgments were his now. He'd hear all manner of things. His advisers would be like lawyers, some arguing one way, some arguing another, to tell him how he was both right and wrong at the same time. But when it was all over, the decision was his alone. President Ryan's hand rubbed his face, heedless of the makeup which he smeared. He didn't know that what Fox and the other networks were sending out was split-screened now, since all had access to the pool feed from the Roosevelt Room. His head shook slightly from side to side in the way of a man who had to accept something he didn't like, his face too blank now for sadness. Behind the Capitol steps, the cranes started dipping again. "Where do we go from here?" the Fox reporter asked. That question wasn't on his list. It was just a human reaction to a human scene. The cut to the hill had bitten deep into the allotted time for the interview, and for another subject they would have carried over into the next segment, but the rules in the White House were adamantine. "Quite a lot of work to be done," Ryan answered. "Thank you, Mr. President. 14 minutes after the hour." Jack watched the light on the TV camera blink off.
The originating producer waited a few seconds before waving his hand, and the president detached his microphone and cable. His first press marathon was over. Before leaving the room, he looked more carefully at the cameras. Earlier in his life, he'd taught classes in history, and, more recently, he'd delivered briefings. But all of those had gone to a live audience whose eyes he could see and read. And from their reaction, he would adjust his delivery somewhat, speeding up or slowing down, maybe tossing in a little humor if circumstances allowed, or repeating something to make his point clearer. Now his intimate chats would be directed to a thing. Something else not to like. Ryan left the room while all over the world people evaluated what they'd seen of the new American president. Television commentators would discuss him in 50 or more countries while he found the bathroom again.
"This is the best thing that's happened to our country since Jefferson."
The older man rated himself a serious student of history. He liked Thomas Jefferson for his statement about how a country governed least was governed best, which was about all he knew of the adages from the Sage of Monticello.
"And it took a Jap to do it, looks like."
The statement was trailed by an ironic snort. Such an event could even invalidate his closely held racism. Couldn't have that, could he? They'd been up all night. It was 5:20 local time, watching the TV news coverage, which hadn't stopped. The newsies, they noted, looked even more wasted than this Ryan guy. Time zones did have an advantage. Both had stopped drinking beer around midnight, and had switched to coffee 2 hours later when they'd both started dozing. Couldn't have that. What they saw, switching through channels downloaded on a large satellite dish outside the cabin, was like some sort of fantastic telethon. Except this one wasn't about raising money for crippled children or AIDS victims or nigger schools. This one was fun. All those Washington bastards must have been burned to a crisp, most of them.
"Bureaucrat barbecue," Peter Holbrook said for the 17th time since 11:30, when he'd come up with his summation of the event. He'd always been the creative one in the movement.
"Ah, shit, Pete," gasped Ernest Brown, spilling some of his coffee into his lap.
It was still funny, enough so that he didn't leap immediately to his feet from the uncomfortable feeling that resulted from his slip.
"Has been a long night," Holbrook allowed, laughing himself.
They'd watched President Durling's speech for a couple of reasons. For one, all of the networks had preempted normal programs, as was usually the case for an important event. But the truth of the matter was that their satellite downlink gave them access to a total of 117 channels, and they didn't even have to switch the set off to avoid input from the government they and their friends despised. The deeper reason was that they cultivated their anger at their government, and usually watched such speeches, both men caught at least an hour a day of C-SPAN 1 and 2, to fuel those feelings, trading barbed comments back and forth every minute of a presidential speech.
"So who is this Ryan guy, really?" Brown asked, yawning. "Another crat, looks like. A bureaucrat talking bureaucrap."
"Yeah," judged Brown. "With nothing to back him up, Pete."
Holbrook turned and looked at his friend.
"It's really something, isn't it?"
With that observation, he got up and walked to the bookshelves that walled the south side of his den. His copy of the Constitution was a well-thumbed pamphlet edition which he read as often as he could, so as to improve his understanding of the intent of the drafters.
"You know, Pete, there's nothing in here to cover a situation like this."
"Really?"
Holbrook nodded.
"Really?"
"No shit."
That required some thought, didn't it? "Murdered?" President Ryan asked, still wiping the makeup off his face with wet towelettes of the same sort he'd used to clean off baby bottoms. At least it made his face feel clean when he'd finished.
"That's the preliminary indication. both from a cursory examination of the body and from a quick and dirty examination of the cockpit tapes. Murray flipped through the notes faxed to him only 20 minutes before. Ryan leaned back in his chair. Like much else in the Oval Office, it was new. On the credenza behind him, all of Durling's family and personal photos had been removed. The papers on the desk had been taken away for examination by the presidential secretarial staff. What remained, or what had been substituted, were accoutrements from White House stores. The chair, at least, was a good one, expensively designed to protect the back of its occupant, and it would soon be substituted for a custom-designed chair fitted to his own back by a manufacturer who performed the service for free, and, remarkably, without public fanfare. Sooner or later, he'd have to work in this place, Jack had decided a few minutes earlier. The secretaries were here, and it wasn't fair to make them trek across the building up and downstairs. Sleeping in this place was another issue entirely, for the moment. That, too, had to change, didn't it? So, he thought, staring across the desk at Murray. Murder. Shot? Dan shook his head. Knife, right in the heart. Only one penetration. The wound looked to our agent to be from a thin blade like a steak knife. From the cockpit tapes, it appears that it was done prior to takeoff. Looks like we can timestamp that pretty exactly. From just prior to engine startup to the moment of impact, the only voice on the tapes is the pilot. His name was Sato, a very experienced command pilot. The Japanese police have gotten a pile of data to us. It would seem that he lost a brother and a son in the war. The brother commanded a destroyer that got sunk with all hands. The son was a fighter pilot who cracked up on landing after a mission. Both on the same day, or near enough. So it was personal. Motive and opportunity, Jack, Murray allowed himself to say. For they were almost alone in the office. Andrea Price was there, too. She didn't quite approve. She had not yet been told exactly how far back the two men went. That's pretty fast on the ID, Price observed. It has to be firmed up, Murray agreed. We'll do that with DNA testing, just to be sure. The cockpit tape is good enough for voice print analysis, or so they told our agent. The Canadians have radar tapes tracking the aircraft out of their airspace, so confirming the timing of the event is simple. We have the aircraft firmly ID'd from Guam to Japan to Vancouver, and into the Capitol building. Like they say, it's all over but the shouting. There will be a lot of shouting. Mr. President, Andrea Price felt better this time. It will be at least 2 months before we have every lead and tidbit of information nailed down, and I suppose it's possible that we could be wrong. But for all practical purposes, in my opinion and that of our senior agents at the scene, this case is well on its way to being closed.
What could make you wrong? Ryan asked.
Potentially, quite a few things. But there are practical considerations. For this to be anything other than the act of a single fanatic... No, that's not fair, is it? One very angry man. Anyway, for this to be a conspiracy, we have to assume detailed planning. And that's hard to support. How would they know the war was going to be lost? How did they know about the joint session? And if it were planned as a war operation, like the NTSB guy said... Hell, 10 tons of high explosive would have been simple to load aboard.
Or a nuke, Jack interjected.
Or a nuke. Murray nodded. Well, that reminds me. The Air Force attaché is going to see their nuclear weapons fabrication facility today. It took the Japanese a couple of days to figure out where it was. We're having a guy who knows the things fly over there right now.
Murray checked his notes.
Dr. Woodrow Lowell. Oh, I know him. He runs the shop at Lawrence Livermore. Prime Minister Koga told our ambassador that he wants to hand over the damn things PDQ and get them the hell out of his country. Ryan turned his chair around. The windows behind him faced the Washington Monument. That obelisk was surrounded by a circle of flagpoles, all of whose flags were at half-staff.
but he could see that people were lined up for the elevator ride to the top. Tourists who'd come to D.C. to see the sights. Well, they were getting a bargain of sorts, weren't they? The Oval Office windows, he saw, were incredibly thick, just in case one of those tourists had a sniper rifle tucked under his coat. "How much of this can we release?" President Ryan asked. "I'm comfortable with releasing a few things," Murray responded. "You sure?" Price asked. "It's not as though we have to protect evidence for a criminal trial. The subject in the case is dead. We'll chase down all the possibilities of co-conspirators, but the evidence we let go today will not compromise that in any way. I'm not exactly a fan of publicizing criminal evidence, but the people out there want to know something, and in a case like this one, you let them have it." Besides, Price thought, it makes the Bureau look good. With that silent observation, at least one government agency started returning to normal. "Who's running this one at Justice?" she asked instead. "Pat Martin." "Oh, who picked him?" she asked. Ryan turned to see the discourse on this one. Murray almost blushed. "I guess I did. The President said to pick the best career prosecutor, and that's Pat. He's been head of the criminal division for 9 months. Before that, he ran espionage. Ex-Bureau. He's a particularly good lawyer, been there almost 30 years. Bill Shaw wanted him to become a judge. He was talking to the AG about it only last week." "You sure he's good enough?" Jack asked. Price decided to answer. "We've worked with him, too. He's a real pro, and Dan's right, he's real judge material, tough as hell, but also extremely fair. He handled a mob counterfeiting case my old partner ramrodded in New Orleans." "Okay, let him decide what to let out. He can start talking to the press right after lunch." Ryan checked his watch. He'd been president for exactly 12 hours. Colonel Pierre Alexander, U.S. Army, retired, still looked like a soldier, tall and thin and fit, and that didn't bother the dean at all. Dave James immediately liked what he saw as his visitor took his seat, liked him even more for what he'd read in the man's CV, and more still for what he'd learned over the phone. Colonel Alexander, Alex to his friends, of which he had many, was an expert in infectious disease who'd spent 20 productive years in the employ of his government, divided mainly between Walter Reed Army Hospital in Washington and Fort Detrick in Maryland, with numerous field trips sprinkled in. "Graduate of West Point and the University of Chicago Medical School," Dr. James saw. "Good," his eyes again sweeping over the residency and other professional experience entries. The list of published articles ran to 8 single-spaced pages. "Nominated for a couple of important prizes, but not lucky yet. Well, maybe Hopkins could change that." His dark eyes were not especially intense at the moment. By no means an arrogant man, Alexander knew who and what he was. Better yet, knew that Dean James knew. "I know Gus Lawrence," Dean James said with a smile. "We interned together at Peter Brent Brigham," which Harvard had since consolidated into Brigham and Women's. "Brilliant guy," Alexander agreed in his best Creole drawl. It was generally thought that Gus's work on Lassa and Q fever put him in the running for a Nobel Prize. And a great doc. "So why don't you want to work with him in Atlanta? Gus tells me he wants you pretty bad." "Dean James." "Dave," the dean said. "Alex," the colonel responded. There was something to be said for civilian life, after all. Alexander thought of the dean as a 3-star equivalent. Maybe 4 stars. Johns Hopkins carried a lot of prestige. "Dave, I've worked in the lab damn near all my life. I want to treat patients again. CDC would just be more of the same. Much as I like Gus, we did a lot of work together in Brazil back in 1987. We get along just fine," he assured the dean. "I am tired of looking at slides and printouts all the time." And for the same reason, he'd turned down one hell of an offer from Pfizer Pharmaceuticals to head up one of their new labs. Infectious diseases were a coming thing in medicine, and both men hoped that it wasn't too late.
Why the hell, James wondered, hadn't this guy made general officer rank?
Maybe politics, the dean thought. The army had that problem too, just as Hopkins did.
But their loss.
I talked about you with Gus last night.
Oh?
Not that it was surprising. At this level of medicine, everyone knew everyone else.
He says just hire you on the spot.
Good of him, Alexander chuckled.
Before Harry Tuttle at Yale gets you for his lab.
You know Harry?
Yep, and everybody knew what everybody else was doing, too.
Classmates here, the dean explained. We both dated Wendy.
He won.
You know, Alex, there isn't much for me to ask you.
I hope that's good.
It is.
We can start you off as an associate professor working under Ralph Forster. You'll have a lot of lab work, good team to work with. Ralph has put a good shop together in the last 10 years. But we're starting to get a lot of clinical referrals. Ralph's getting a little old to travel so much, so you can expect to get around the world some. You'll also be in charge of the clinical side in, 6 months to get your feet good and wet.
The retired colonel nodded thoughtfully.
That's just about right. I need to relearn a few things. Hell, when does learning ever stop?
When you become an administrator, if you're not careful.
Yeah, well, now you know why I hung up the green suit. They wanted me to command up a hospital, you know, punch the ticket.
Damn it, I know I'm good in a lab, okay? I'm very good in a lab. But I signed on to treat people once in a while, and to teach some, naturally. But I like to see sick people and send them home healthy. Once upon a time, somebody in Chicago told me that's what the job was.
If this was a selling job, Dean James thought, then he'd taken lessons from Olivier. Yale could offer him about the same post, but this one would keep Alexander close to Fort Detrick, and 90 minutes flying time to Atlanta, and close to the Chesapeake Bay. In the resume it said Alexander liked to fish. Well, that figured, growing up in the Louisiana bayous. In sum total, that was Yale's bad luck. Professor Harold Tuttle was as good as they came, maybe a shade better than Ralph Forster. But in 5 years or so, Ralph would retire, and Alexander here had the look of a star. More than anything else, Dean James was in the business of recruiting future stars. In another reality, he would have been the GM for a winning baseball team. So that was settled. James closed the folder on his desk.
Doctor, welcome to the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine.
Thank you, sir.
Chapter 4. OJT. The rest of the day was a blur. Even while living through it, Ryan knew that he'd never really remember more than snippets. His first experience with computers had been as a student at Boston College. Before the age of personal computing, he'd used the dumbest of dumb terminals, a teletype, to communicate with a mainframe somewhere, along with other BC students, and more still from other local schools. That had been called time-sharing, just one more term from a bygone age when computers had cost $1 million or so for performance that now could be duplicated in the average man's watch. But the term still applied to the American presidency, Jack learned, where the ability to pursue a single thought through from beginning to end was the rarest of luxuries, and work consisted of following various intellectual threads from one separate meeting to the next, like keeping track of a whole group of continuing TV series from episode to episode, trying not to confuse one with another, and knowing that avoiding that error was totally impossible. After dismissing Murray and Price, it had begun in earnest. Ryan's introduction began with a national security briefing delivered by one of the national intelligence officers assigned to the White House staff. Here, over a period of 26 minutes, he learned what he already knew because of the job he'd held until the previous day. But he had to sit through it anyway,
if for no other reason than to get a feel for the man who would be one of his daily briefing team. They were all different. Each one had an individual perspective, and Ryan had to understand the nuances peculiar to the separate voices he'd be hearing.
"So nothing on the horizon for now?" Jack asked.
"Nothing we see at the National Security Council, Mr. President. You know the potential trouble spots as well as I do, of course, and those change on a day-to-day basis." The man hedged with the grace of someone who'd been dancing to this particular brand of music for years. Ryan's face didn't change, only because he'd seen it before. A real intelligence officer didn't fear death, didn't fear finding his wife in bed with his best friend, didn't fear any of the normal vicissitudes of life. A national intelligence officer did fear being found wrong on anything he said in his official capacity. To avoid that was simple, however. You never took a real stand on any single thing. It was a disease not limited to elected officials, after all. Only the president had to take a stand, and it was his good fortune to have such trained experts to supply him with the information he needed, wasn't it?
"Let me tell you something," Ryan said after a few seconds of reflection.
"What is that, sir?" the NIO asked cautiously.
"I don't just want to hear what you know. I also want to hear what you and your people think. You are responsible for what you know, but I'll take the heat for acting on what you think. I've been there and done that, okay?"
"Of course, Mr. President." The man allowed himself a smile that masked his terror at the prospect. "I'll pass that along to my people."
"Thank you."
Ryan dismissed the man, knowing then and there that he needed a national security advisor he could trust, and wondering where he'd get one. The door opened as though by magic to let the NIO out. A Secret Service agent had done that, having watched through the spy hole for most of the briefing. The next in was a DOD briefing team. The senior man was a two-star who handed over a plastic card.
"Mr. President, you need to put this in your wallet."
Jack nodded, knowing what it was before his hands touched the orange plastic. It looked like a credit card, but on it was a series of number groups.
"Which one?" Ryan asked.
"You decide, sir." Ryan did so, reading off the third such group twice. There were two commissioned officers with the general, a colonel and a major, both of whom wrote down the number group he'd selected and read it back to him twice. President Ryan now had the ability to order the release of strategic nuclear weapons.
"Why is this necessary?" he asked. "We trashed the last ballistic weapons last year."
"Mr. President, we still have cruise missiles which can be armed with W-80 warheads, plus B-61 gravity bombs assigned to our bomber fleet. We need your authorization to enable the permissible action links, the PALs, and the idea is that we enable them as early as possible, just in case."
Ryan completed the sentence. "I get taken out early."
"You're really important now, Jack," a nasty little voice told him. "Now you can initiate a nuclear attack."
"I hate those goddamn things. Always have."
"You aren't supposed to like them, sir," the general sympathized. "Now, as you know, the Marines have the VMH-1 helicopter squadron that's always ready to get you out of here and to a place of safety at a moment's notice, and..." Ryan listened to the rest while his mind wondered if he should do what Jimmy Carter had done at this point. "Okay, let's see then. Tell them I want them to pick me up now." Which presidential command had turned into a major embarrassment for a lot of Marines. But he couldn't do that now, could he? It would get out that Ryan was a paranoid fool, not someone who wanted to see if the system really worked the way people said it would. Besides, today VMH-1 would definitely be spun up, wouldn't it? The fourth member of the briefing team was an Army warrant officer in civilian clothes, who carried a quite ordinary-looking briefcase known as the football, inside of which was a binder, inside of which was the attack plan. Actually, a whole set of them.
Let me see it.
Ryan pointed.
The warrant hesitated, then unlocked the case and handed over the navy blue binder, which Ryan flipped open.
Sir, we haven't changed it since...
The first section, Jack saw, was labeled Major Attack Option. It showed a map of Japan, many of whose cities were marked with multicolored dots. The legend at the bottom showed what the dots meant in terms of delivered megatonnage. Probably another page would quantify the predicted deaths. Ryan opened the binder rings and removed the whole section.
I want these pages burned. I want this MAO eliminated immediately.
That merely meant that it would be filed away in some drawer in Pentagon war plans, and also in Omaha. Things like this never died.
Sir, we have not yet confirmed that the Japanese have destroyed all of their launchers, nor have we confirmed the neutralization of their weapons. You see,
General, that's an order, Ryan said quietly. I can give them, you know.
The man's back braced to attention.
Yes, Mr. President.
Ryan flipped through the rest of the binder. Despite his previous job, what he found was a revelation. Jack had always avoided too intimate knowledge of the damn things. He'd never expected them to be used. After the terrorist incident in Denver, and all the horror that had swept the surface of the planet and its aftermath, statesmen across continents and political beliefs had indulged themselves in a collective think about the weapons under their control. Even during the shooting war with Japan just ended, Ryan had known that somewhere, some team of experts had concocted a plan for a nuclear retaliatory strike. But he'd concentrated his efforts at making it unnecessary. And it was a source of considerable pride to the new president that he'd never even contemplated implementing the plan whose summary was still in his left hand. Long Rifle, he saw, was the code name. Why did the names have to be like that, virile and exciting, as though for something that one could be proud of?
What's this one? Light switch.
Mr. President, the general answered, that's a method of using an EMP attack. Electromagnetic pulse. If you explode a device at very high altitude, there's nothing, no air actually, to absorb the initial energy of the detonation and convert it into mechanical energy. No shockwave, that is. As a result, all the energy goes out in its original electromagnetic form. The resulting energy surge is murder on power and telephone lines. We always had a bunch of weapons fused for high-altitude burst in our SIOPs for the Soviet Union. Their telephone system was so primitive that it would have been easy to destroy. It's a cheap mission kill. Won't really hurt anybody on the ground.
I see.
Ryan closed the binder and handed it back to the warrant officer, who immediately locked the now lighter document away.
I take it there's nothing going on which is likely to require a nuclear strike of any kind?
Correct, Mr. President.
So what's the point of having this man sitting outside my office all the time?
You can't predict all possible contingencies, can you, sir? The general asked. It must have been difficult for him to deliver the line with a straight face, Ryan realized, as soon as the shock went away.
I guess not. A chastised president replied.
The White House protocol office was headed by a lady named Judy Simmons, who'd been seconded to the White House staff from the State Department 4 months earlier. Her office in the basement of the building had been busy since just after midnight, when she'd arrived from her home in Burke, Virginia. Her thankless job was to prepare arrangements for what would be the largest state funeral in American history, a task on which over 100 staff members had already kibitzed, and it was not yet lunchtime. The list of all the dead still had to be compiled, but from careful examination of the videotapes, it was largely known who was in the chamber, and there was biographical information on all of them, married or single, religion, etc., from which to make the necessary, if preliminary, plans. Whatever was finally decided, Jack would be the master of the grim ceremony, and had to be kept informed of every step of the planning. A funeral for thousands, Ryan thought, most of whom he hadn't known.
for most of whose, as yet unrecovered bodies, waited wives and husbands and children.
National Cathedral, he saw, turning the page.
The approximate numbers of religious affiliations had been compiled. That would determine the clergy to take the various functions in the ecumenical religious service.
That's where such ceremonies are usually carried out, Mr. President, a very harried official confirmed. There will not be room for all the remains.
She didn't say that one White House staffer had suggested an outdoor memorial service at RFK Stadium in order to accommodate all the victims.
But there will be room for the President and Mrs. Durling, plus a representative sampling of the congressional victims. We've contacted 11 foreign governments on the question of the diplomats who were present. We also have a preliminary list of foreign government representatives who will be coming in to attend the ceremony.
She handed over that sheet as well.
Ryan scanned it briefly. It meant that after the memorial service he'd be meeting informally with numerous chiefs of state to conduct informal business. He'd need a briefing page for each meeting, and in addition to whatever they all might ask or want, everyone would be checking him out. Jack knew how that worked. All over the world, presidents, prime ministers, and a few lingering dictators would now be reading briefing documents of their own. Who was this John Patrick Ryan, and what can we expect of him? He wondered if they had a better idea of the answer than he did. Probably not. Their NIOs wouldn't be all that different from his, after all. And so a raft of them would come over on government jets, partly to show respect for President Durling and the American government, partly to eyeball the new American president, partly for domestic political consumption at home, and partly because it was expected that they should do so. And so this event, horrific as it was for uncounted thousands, was just one more mechanical exercise in the world of politics. Jack wanted to cry out in rage, but what else was there to do? The dead were dead, and all his grief could not bring them back, and the business of his country and others would go on.
Have Scott Adler go over this, will you?
Somebody would have to determine how much time he should spend with the official visitors, and Ryan wasn't qualified to do that.
Yes, Mr. President.
What sort of speeches will I have to deliver? Jack asked.
We're having our people work on that for you. You should have preliminary drafts by tomorrow afternoon, Mrs. Simmons replied.
President Ryan nodded and slid the papers into his outpile. When the chief of protocol left, a secretary came in. He didn't know this lady's name, with a pile of telegrams, the leftovers from 8th and I that he hadn't gotten to, plus another sheet of paper that showed his activities for the day, prepared without his input or assistance. He was about to grumble about that when she spoke.
"We have over 10,000 telegrams and emails from, well, from citizens," she told him.
"Saying what?"
"Mainly that they're praying for you."
"Oh." Somehow that came as a surprise, and a humbling one at that. But would God listen? Jack went back to reading the official messages, and the first day went on. The country had essentially come to a halt, even as its new president struggled to come to terms with his new job. Banks and financial markets were closed, as were schools and many businesses. All the television networks had moved their broadcast headquarters to the various Washington bureaus in a haphazard process that had them all working together. A gang of cameras sighted around the hill kept up a continuous feed of recovery operations, while reporters had to keep talking, lest the airwaves be filled with silence. Around 11 that morning, a crane removed the remains of the 747's tail, which was deposited on a large flatbed trailer for transport to a hangar at Andrews Air Force Base. That would be the site for what was called the crash investigation, for want of a better term, and cameras tracked the vehicle as it threaded its way along the streets. Two of the engines went out shortly thereafter in much the same way. Various experts helped fill the silence, speculating on what had happened and how. This was difficult for everyone involved,
as there had been few leaks as yet. Those who were trying to find out what had happened were too busy to talk with reporters on or off the record. And though the journalists couldn't say it, their most fertile source of leaks lay in ruin before 34 cameras. That gave the experts little to say. Witnesses were interviewed for their recollections. There was no tape of the inbound aircraft at all, much to the surprise of everyone. The tail number of the aircraft was known. It could hardly be missed, painted as it was on the wreckage of the aircraft, and that was as easily checked by reporters as by federal authorities. The ownership of the aircraft by Japan Airlines was immediately confirmed, along with the very day the aircraft had rolled out of the Boeing plant near Seattle. Officials of that company submitted to interviews, and along the way it was determined that the 747-400 PIP aircraft weighed just over 200 tons empty, a number doubled with the mass of fuel, passengers, and baggage it could pull into the air. A pilot with United Airlines, who was familiar with the aircraft, explained to two of the networks how a pilot could approach Washington and then execute the death dive, while a Delta colleague did the same with the others. Both airmen were mistaken in some of the particulars, none of them important. "But the Secret Service is armed with anti-aircraft missiles, isn't it?" one anchor asked. "If you've got an 18-wheeler heading for you at 60 miles an hour, and you shoot out one of the tires on the trailer, that doesn't stop the truck, does it?" the pilot answered, noting the look of concentrated intelligence on the face of a highly paid journalist who understood little more than what appeared on his teleprompter. 300 tons of aircraft doesn't just stop, okay?" "So there was no way to stop it?" the anchor asked with a twisted face. "None at all." The pilot could see that the reporter didn't understand, but he couldn't come up with anything to clarify matters further. The director, in his control room off of Nebraska Avenue, changed cameras to follow a pair of guardsmen bringing another body down the steps. An assistant director was keeping an eye on that set of cameras, trying to maintain a running tally of the number of bodies removed. It was now known that the bodies of President and Mrs. Durling had been recovered and were at Walter Reed Army Medical Center for autopsy, required by law for wrongful death, and disposition. At network headquarters in New York, every foot of videotape of or about Durling was being organized and spliced for presentation throughout the day. Political colleagues were being sought out and interviewed. Psychologists were taken on to explain how the Durling children could deal with the trauma, and then expanded their horizons to talk about the impact of the event on the country as a whole, and how people could deal with it. About the only thing not examined on the television news was the spiritual aspect. That many of the victims had believed in God and attended church from time to time was not worthy of airtime, though the presence of many people in churches was deemed newsworthy enough for 3 minutes on one network. And then, because each was constantly monitoring the others for ideas, that segment was copied by the others over the next few hours. It all came down to this, really, Jack knew. The numbers only added individual examples, identical to this one in magnitude and horror. He avoided it for as much of the day as had been possible, but finally his cowardice had run out. The Durling kids hovered between the numbness of denial and terror of a world destroyed before their eyes as they'd watched their father on TV. They'd never see Mom and Dad again. The bodies were far too damaged for the caskets to be open. No last goodbyes, no words, just the traumatic removal of the foundation that held up their young lives. And how were children supposed to understand that Mom and Dad weren't just Mom and Dad, but were, had been, something else to someone else? And for that reason, their deaths had been necessary to someone who hadn't known or cared about the kids. Family members had descended on Washington, most of them flown in by the Air Force from California. Equally shocked, they nevertheless, in the presence of children, had to summon from within themselves the strength to make things somewhat easier for the young. And it gave them something to do. The Secret Service agents assigned to Juniper and Junior
were probably the most traumatized of all. Trained to be ferociously protective of any principal, the agents who looked after the Durling kids, more than half were women, carried the additional burden of the normal solicitude any human held for any child, and none of them would have hesitated a microsecond to give his or her life to protect the youngsters, in the knowledge that the rest of the detail would have weapons out and blazing. The men and women of this sub-detail had played with the kids, had bought them Christmas and birthday presents, had helped with homework. Now they were saying goodbye to the kids, to the parents, and to colleagues. Ryan saw the looks on their faces, and made a mental note to ask Andrea if the service would assign a psychologist to them. No, it didn't hurt. Jack was sitting down so that the kids could look level into his eyes. It didn't hurt at all.
Okay, Mark Durling said.
The kids were immaculately dressed. One of the family members had thought it important that they be properly turned out to meet their father's successor. Jack heard a gasp of breath, and his peripheral vision caught the face of an agent, this one a man, who was on the edge of losing it. Price grabbed his arm and moved him toward the door before the kids could take note of it.
"Do we stay here?"
"Yes," Jack assured him. It was a lie, but not the sort to hurt anyone. "And if you need anything, anything at all, you can come and see me, okay?" The boy nodded, doing his best to be brave, and it was time to leave him to his family. Ryan squeezed his hand, treating him like the man he ought not to have become for years, for whom the duties of manhood were arriving all too soon. The boy needed to cry, and Ryan thought he needed to do that alone, for now. Jack walked out the door into the oversized hall of the bedroom level. The agent who'd left, a tall, rugged-looking black man, was sobbing 10 feet away. Ryan went over to him.
"You okay?"
"Fuck. Sorry, I mean shit," the agent shook his head, ashamed at the display of emotion. His father had been lost in an army training accident at Fort Rucker, Price knew, when he was 12 years old, and Special Agent Tony Wills, who'd played tight end at Grambling before joining the service, was unusually good with kids. At times like this, strengths often became weaknesses.
"Don't apologize for being human. I lost my mom and dad, too. Same time," Ryan went on, his voice dreamy and uneven with fatigue. "Midway Airport, 737 landed short in snow. But I was all grown up when it happened."
"I know, sir." The agent wiped his eyes and stood erect with a shudder. "I'll be okay." Ryan patted him on the shoulder and headed for the elevator. To Andrea Price, "Get me the hell out of here." The Suburban headed north, turning left onto Massachusetts Avenue, which led to the Naval Observatory and the oversized Victorian gingerbread barn which the country provided for the sitting vice president. Again, it was guarded by Marines who let the convoy through. Jack walked into the house. Kathy was waiting at the entry. She only needed one look.
"Tough one?"
All Ryan could do was nod. He held her tight, knowing that his tears would start soon. His eyes caught the knot of agents around the periphery of the entry hall of the house, and it occurred to him that he'd have to get used to them, standing like impassive statues, present in the most private of moments. "I hate this job." But Brigadier General Marion Diggs loved his. Not everyone had stood down. As the Marine barracks in Washington had gone to a high level of activity, then to be augmented from the sprawling base at Quantico, Virginia, so other organizations remained busy or became busier, for they were people who were not really allowed to sleep anyway, at least not all of them at once. One of these organizations was at Fort Irwin, California. Located in the high Mojave Desert, the base really did sprawl, over an area larger than the state of Rhode Island. The landscape was bleak enough that ecologists had to struggle to find an ecology there among the scrawny creosote bushes. And over drinks,
Even the most dedicated of that profession would confess to finding the surface of the moon far more interesting. Not that they hadn't made his life miserable, Diggs thought, fingering his binoculars. There was a species of desert tortoise which was distinguished from a turtle somehow or other, the general didn't have a clue, and which soldiers had to protect. To take care of that, his soldiers had collected all the tortoises they could find, and then relocated them to an enclosure large enough